I'd like to welcome everybody to X9 Seminar on Blockchain Technology presented by IBM. My name is Steve Stevens. I'm the Executive Director of the Accredited Standards Committee, X9. When everybody joins, we should have about 300 people, which is the number that registered. In fact, we're getting a few last-minute ones right now. This will be one of our largest seminars today. We usually try to have a couple a year, but there seems to be a lot of interest. Thank you for your participation. It's also our plan to have more seminars like this as possible on a regular basis. We're looking for some different topics. We're going to have at least a couple more on blockchain, and then we've got some other topics that we're going to be trying to find speakers for. So if anybody has any ideas or things they would like to hear, please send me an email. I'll be happy to try to find something in those areas. I want to thank the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis for letting us use their phone conferencing system. Specifically, I want to thank Claudia Swinset and Cynthia Baxter this morning for us. They've been there anytime we need their help. They're always there to provide some of the services that we need. I want to thank them. Thank you both for that. I have a couple of quick housekeeping issues I want to go over. We do not, and I repeat, do not have a global mute. Please put your phones on mute. Otherwise, it'll be just about impossible to carry on a conversation or have the presentation with so many phones not muted. It doesn't take but a few to cause problems. We will have a question and answer time at the end of the presentation. So if you'll save your questions until then, that would be appreciated. We are recording this seminar, and it'll take about a day to 2 days to get it ready for replay, but I'll send out a link with the URL so that you can listen to it, or if you want to send it to somebody that couldn't make it today, you can forward the email. In case you, some people had some trouble viewing or getting access to the presentation with the link I sent out on Friday. I sent out another link this morning. We've also put a copy on the X9's public website. So if you look at the email I sent out around 10 this morning, there's an alternate address at the bottom where you can download the presentations and follow along. And I think that's all the housekeeping. I don't see anything else on my list here. I want to thank everybody else again for attending our seminar on blockchain technology. And I'll turn it over now to Todd Arnold from IBM. Todd is our IBM representative on the X9 Board of Directors. I want to thank him for many, many years of service to X9 and help. And I'll let Todd introduce our guest speaker. Todd?
Okay, so the speaker today is Nitin Garr from IBM. And as Steve said, I've been asked to introduce him because he and I both work for IBM, and as many as you know, I have worked in X9F for a long, long time. So a brief introduction. Nitin is officially the director of IBM Blockchain Labs, and in that role, he's more or less the person who is running the IBM blockchain effort, but there are actually a lot of other people involved, people from IBM research, IBM product development teams, people who work directly with customers, and so forth. So I know that Nitin spends a lot of his time working with customers to try and help them understand what IBM is doing in blockchain and what blockchain is all about, and I'm sure his talk today is going to be very interesting for all of you from X9, and so without further ado, I will turn it over.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you, Stephen, and happy to be here. In fact, I think I've been working with Todd on many different issues that have come up, you know, that have spawned up from our client activity, and I'm really excited to actually be here for X9 because I've been working, or at least participating, in a group that Claudia or the Federal Reserve, you know, of Minneapolis runs in terms of the digital currency group, and which again I think is a part of the overall TC68. And talking to her and her team, and eventually talking to Todd, made me realize that how important it is for the X9, which I believe is the Standards Committee on Banking, in defining some of the standardization to facilitate the banking operations. And from that perspective, I think that this discussion is meaningful only because 99% of our conversation around blockchain has been with financial services institutions, right? And so if you look at the diaspora of the ecosystem that's revolving around blockchain, while it's not just confined to financial services and has broader applicability to healthcare, identity management, and things like that, I think financial services is largely focused on this for two reasons, right? So I'll spend some time on discussing one of the, you know, sort of the summary of a conversation that I've had with clients. My count with clients have gone to 114 now of different banks, primarily because we had a huge conference last week in Las Vegas, and we were heads down and discussing with many of the financial services and banks in terms of what the agenda is and where blockchain fits in that innovation agenda. Slide two, and I want this to be organic. I probably will not go through all slides. I personally am a whiteboard kind of guy, but given the circumstances, I have to use slides to be able to communicate a few things. So I'm going to call the slides number out and define the structure of what we're going to talk about and eventually leave around between 40-plus minutes towards the end for Q&A, because I believe we do have a lot of Q&A that should emerge from this conversation. Slide two really describes some of the structure of this presentation. So if you look at slide one, we talk about making blockchain real for business. And that's a moniker that we're using only because if you look at blockchain from the fact that, you know, it emanates from the Bitcoin blockchain world, which is, you know, again, questionable cryptocurrency, and we've learned a lot of things from it. But as we engage with clients, it's imperative to understand the challenges, the immense potential that blockchain has for disruption and for improving stack of processes, but also the challenges that the enterprise would have to consume this as a viable technology, right? And so we use the moniker making blockchain real for business because IBM, that started me, you know, my employer, we've been in transaction business since inception of transactions. And so also want to be able to have a point of view and perspective that if blockchain were to be that next generation transaction system, then we want to have skin in the game, we want to have perspective and leverage our experience that we have gained over the past, you know, 60 plus years in this space to be able to move that towards the next generation transaction system. I say 60 plus years because, of course, IBM has been there for over 105 years, but the origination of the transaction system has been a little over 60 years in terms of the modern day, you know, the modern day banking systems. A few opinions. So again, slide two is the structure. We'll talk about what is blockchain. I'll lay down some of the fundamental tenets. There are about 300 people on this call, so I don't want to assume anything. So I'll lay some of the basic tenets of blockchain, some of the terminology that's been used in the industry, so we are on the same page. And the second part of the transaction is why. Why is it relevant for business? I'll also spend some time in some of the real use cases that have been emerging in financial services. What I will skip is the how part of it. This is a master deck that we create for our clients, and I would leave the how piece alone only because the audience is not right. This is usually for commercial enterprises that we talk about what is the IBM's, you know, what can IBM do to help our clients to get from ideation to the next phase of the first project and eventually move into us productionizing the environment. So I'll leave the how alone for your interpretation, and there's enough slides towards the end that will talk about our initiatives that include some of the recent announcements from standardizing a few things that we are trying to do in blockchain because there are really no standards at the moment. So with that, I want to sort of lay out a few things, a few opinions that is relevant for this conversation, which is also relevant for this audience from an X9 perspective. Is that today, from a blockchain perspective, despite currently lacking unanimous definitions and standards, the blockchain technology itself is viewed as a next-generation technology that is aimed to disrupt the status quo in existing market infrastructure and change the way financial institutions operate their day-to-day businesses. And this is an important sort of assertion here only because of the fact there are, you know, on a daily basis, there are today about 4,000 different fintech companies trying to disrupt every element of financial services that has a friction. So everything that has a friction, that has a high fee structure, there is a fintech trying to attack that model, which collectively for a financial system, it's a two-way challenge. One, it's trying to, one, bring out the inefficiencies in the marketplace. Second thing is it's trying to create a interesting paradigm for the regulators to understand what is the role of these new fintechs and how they fit in, which earlier was a fairly, you know, finite set of things to regulate. Suddenly you have a sprawling ecosystem. So that's an important element to keep in mind. Second thing is we will use the use permission and permissionless blockchain permissionless is something akin to the Bitcoin world, which in regulated market today, it's practically impossible to fathom how that'll surface. But typically a system that's built on top of a permission blockchain, which is what we are envisioning, with focus on logic optimization and creating a more suitable candidate for market for capital market adoption. You'll find that despite the lack of any successful implementation in capital markets to date, which means that there are many experimentations, you'll find a lot of press releases of all the banks pretty much doing something on a daily basis with blockchain. There are really no successful implementation yet which has gone to production. They all have taken a small approach of creating some advanced stage of experimentation, moving some of the, you know, some of the transactions, but nothing that's successfully implemented to date. And all the discussions about blockchain's potential benefits have resulted in at least one positive outcome, right? And this is the premise of what we're doing here, is increased public discussion. And this is why we're having this call with 300 plus people, and I'm pretty much spending 17 hours a day either talking to clients, talking to some public forum, or even internally talking to IBM Research in terms of how do we make this meaningful, is increased public discussion how certain parts of capital markets are woefully inefficient and how technology such as blockchain and industry acknowledgement and consensus around existing shortfalls could help the key market participation, which allows us to make tough choices that would create sort of a solid foundation for the future growth. Right, so this whole disruption that the fintech industry is imposing on the financial services has a positive outcome and a negative outcome. Positive outcome is the fact that suddenly everything is being questioned that has been there for 30 plus years, the fee structures, the time to market, the T plus X conversation, and the liquidity risk that comes with it. And so from that perspective, it's positive. And the downside of it is that suddenly the regulators, which many of us here work on or work with, would have to suddenly have a grasp of understanding of how this will sort of surface in the financial services. So with that premise of an opinion, I want to move on to slide 3 in sort of defining some of the terms that are constantly used in this space. So whenever you talk to anybody in blockchain, you have to understand this. And for the first time, and I have an interesting background, I have a degree in financial. I have a degree in technology, which today, after so many years, I'm able to actually merge them together and have a meaningful conversation with clients, because all our conversation is actually starting from this business world, eventually end towards, you know, how technology really mires that vision into reality. So you'll find the notion of business networks, which, by the way, is the holy grail of what we're trying to achieve. This is not now, but it's 10 years from now, you know, statement, and market and wealth, right? So business networks are emerging, which if you look at the existing financial system in general, you have sort of the consortium networks, and eventually they all tie in, whether it's cross-border payments or moving money from a different geo or different entities, whether it's retail banking to mortgage space. It's a complex web of business networks. And that complex web creates an interesting dichotomy where suddenly we have introduced this many counterparties in the system to, one, act as shock absorbers, and two, to ensure that there is a trusted system in place. Now, these intermediaries, as we know, provide a service and of value. The fact that, you know, one, that there's a trust implied in the system, and suddenly I have a vehicle to be able to move things around with different counterparties to check, you know, to have checks and balances. But while these counterparties provide a value and historically have provided value of inducing a trust system in this massive financial network, this also induces a challenge where they have a fee structure associated with it. They also have delays only because of the fact that suddenly each of these counterparties have to ensure that their books are in order and everything is falling in place. This is where this becomes interesting from a blockchain perspective, from a technology application perspective, and as we discuss this forward, that the industry is saying that moving things of value, be it money, be it, you know, bonds and stocks and mortgages, should be as simple as what we have achieved in the past decade and two decades or so with internet around emails and file transfer. So we have SMTP and we have FTP and we have all these different technology standards developed for moving files and moving digits between multiple entities with a complex system of web. So you send an email to me, it's truly a decentralized system governed by a few rules in the system. An email comes to me, and while you may all have different email systems, there's a protocol in place to move email and to move files, to do them securely and so on and so forth. And if you were to take the holy grail of where blockchain is heading, is towards mimicking that model for moving things of value, right? And so in future, it should be moving things of value should be as simple, whether it's dematerialized assets or even digital representation of assets between multiple entities, should be as simple as in a trust environment. This also brings an interesting challenge to the existing system. If we are trying to achieve that level of future, if we are trying to go towards that future where suddenly I have enough trust built into the system, we have to have a robust mechanism that either mimics and makes the existing system better. This is where the challenge lies, and I'll spend more time on this challenge later, but that's what we mean when we say, when we use business networks. So blockchain as an individual technology is of little value or can provide little value from a shared ledgering perspective, which is a common term that we use for any use cases inside of a single entity or single bank or single financial institution. But it has a much better and broader application and broader benefit of that application if we were to take this to the business network. Right. So more on this as we continue. Then we talk about wealth and markets. Right. Wealth, and this is where we differ, and I like to discuss this head on. While IBM and many of our financial services neither want to do anything or talk about blockchain or Bitcoin blockchain, Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency and has challenges in terms of AML, KYC, the fact that anonymity, which is touted as a strength of the Bitcoin network, we who all live in this regulated financial world is a challenge, right? If I cannot eventually track where the money's gone, if I cannot associate the money receipt with an individual or a corporation, it becomes hard for me to do AML, you know, analysis and tied with this the KYC element of it. But also, the notion of wealth generation in this Bitcoin world is the fact that you're sort of dealing with, and I've written a paper on this on my LinkedIn profile, the notion of economic inclusion, the way we generate wealth today is, you know, you either produce something using your intellectual capital or your farm, or so there's a whole way to generate wealth in our economy, and suddenly this Bitcoin world is generating wealth purely on a model that's devised and which addresses a very small subset of the world population. So that's a challenge. But you also realize that the wealth generated has to be moved. And so the second element of it is that in our existing economy, when we move the wealth around, if what internet has done for information, which is rapid consumption of information and eventually bringing the world on the same, you know, level playing field, if we have done that for information, can we not do that for economics? Can we not do that for things of value? So if I can move money fast enough, can that help me improvise the economy around the world, move things faster? And if I were to do that to that model, then how do I induce the appropriate checks and balances in the system that allows me to do it in a meaningful fashion, in a fashion that's compliant with the existing regulation, not just the both by the country themselves, but also the international organization that has laid standards that includes the ISO, ANSI, TC68, and things like that. And then you have the markets, which is more towards the central to the process that, again, it's all about business network, is how do we create this market, whether it's public or private. Public meaning that today I have the ability for me to be able to buy stock in different areas. You have the ADRs, which allows the companies to be able to offer stocks in American markets. I have the ability to buy corporate bonds and government bonds of different countries from a certain set of markets. And, of course, depending on how I interact with the market, I have to pay the appropriate fee structure and deal with the time it takes for me to be able to realize the fruit of that participation in the market. So these things become even more relevant when we talk about a market participation of what blockchain or shared ledgering is all about. So that's one thing, and I'll spend more time in technology-wise on how we're addressing it. Slide 4, also an important slide, where we talk about the different types of asset. And the reason why I discuss this here is because there are notion around when you do commerce on web, there's one element of moving the dematerialized element of that, whether it's a receipt, whether it's e-invoicing, and the other element is the physical movements of goods and things of value, right? And so in this case, I do want to bring forth the transferring of asset and building value is you'd really have two fundamental types of assets, tangible and intangible. In some cases, for example, things like gold and commodities, we do have a tangible assets and those assets are traded in a dematerialized form in markets, right? And then you also have the intangible assets, bonds and patents and DRM or digital rights management These are the issues that are extend beyond the financial systems, where suddenly I have, if you look at the music, the way the royalties are distributed right now, the artists who are getting paid at the tail end of this, you know, ecosystem, they really have no way to find out as to how their asset or the music they created or the patent that was created by a company is being utilized at the other end. So we're looking at using of the shared ledger and blockchain technology to be able to have the end-to-end visibility of this entire process, giving an enterprise, whether it's financial or non-financial enterprises, a full visibility into what's happening, which again hinges upon the transparency that the Bitcoin world has shown us. So while we cannot do many things that Bitcoin world has done for us, we still want to be able to take all the good aspects of this, whether it's transparency or having the ability for us to be able to create this unlinked identities in the system. Same thing with about cash, and I think if you look at what Claudia's group and the group she leads in terms of looking at digital currency group is discerning between digital currency, cybercurrency, and cryptocurrency. And I think we should, as a group here, who are, in my opinion, the 300 people here are the world leaders in what we do in our interface with our financial services clients, is to have a point of view and discern between what's happening with digital currency, cryptocurrency, and cybercurrencies, right? And they all, while may be used interchangeably in our conversations, actually are different, and we should discern between the two. Slide 6 brings to, and again, I'm diving now deeper into some of the heart of what we're trying to solve in the industry with blockchain, is ledgers. And ledger, historically, this really picture shows about, if back in the day, and there are many, and I've traveled many countries to understand the financial systems, that includes countries in India, Bangladesh, Kenya, Uganda, to understand how these banking systems work and how there's a bridge between the modern-day banking system versus the unbanked customers. And the ledgering system is an interesting element where suddenly I'm keeping records, and in many cases, our modern-day financial system is all about ledgering, right? So if you look at Nostros, Wostros, the use case of transferring money between the corresponding banks that deal with these international systems, at the end of the day, it's simply a ledger entry that moves and shows us the balance of payments between multiple different corresponding banks in multiple countries. The idea is that, and this is where the challenge comes in, that if you look at some of the challenges with keeping the ledger entry system, so we are spending now, and I've done experiments where I've sent money to different countries, and depending on where you send countries, it may take anywhere between a day and 7 days. The reason why it takes that much time is because all these corresponding banks have to ensure that the ledger entries are in order, and suddenly I have a system that in many cases I can wire the money and kiss my money goodbye, because the visibility of the system is so fragmented that we really don't know where it is until it reaches the end party and I have a verbal confirmation or some sort of individual confirmation from the other entity. That, in my opinion, is an inefficient system suddenly in this day and age, when it's not just about digitization, it's also about, and you'll find many companies like Earthport and Ripple and TransferWise trying to address that from a fintech perspective, is how do we speed that up? How do we give that value and reduce the fee structure, which today is an average fee structure, is anywhere between 10% of the overall transfer amount to minimum of $40, which in just to transfer money is an enormous amount of money being bled from the system. And you'll find that that is an element, that is the fundamental element of what we're trying to do with shared ledgering process, that if all the entity involved have access to the same set of information and datagram, and we are now instituting certain set of trusted entities to do it, then suddenly I'm making this process more efficient, and I'll spend more time when I go into technology pieces of this. Slide 6 really talks about participants. I think it's an important element of it, that who is participating in this network. So if you talk about this complex, mimicking our existing financial network, if you bring in this notion of, different participants, you may have government, you may have regulators, you may have, what is the role of them in the network? And this becomes more apparent when we talk about setting up that business network and having folks bring up their computer equity, because we cannot operate, I don't think the permission network or the regulated network can operate on an incentive economic that the Bitcoin network operates on, based on Bitcoins. So we have to really figure out as to when we move this into permission network, what is the incentive economics for the participants, and you have different types of participants, to not only contribute to the upkeep of the network, but also ensure that we have rational behavior and they're penalized for having a bad reputation. Right. And this, again, ties back into creating this new world when if people are not behaving right, if you have, for example, what we have seen in information network, which is the Internet, what happens to spammers? What happens to folks who are using phishing attacks? And then eventually you have the whitelist and the blacklist of the networks, and suddenly you have a system in place which is designed to remove the bad elements so that we can transact efficiently, expecting that there will be bad players every now and then, and we have to have designed a system to eliminate those bad players. So these participant transaction contracts gives us a vehicle to set the boundaries and the guidelines for who participates in the network, what's their role, what's their investment, and what's the incentive they receive for simply participating in the network. Same thing with transactions. It's an asset transfer with the premise that you're dealing with one asset can be only owned by one entity at one time, addressing the double spend problem, which we have seen in the commerce transaction, things of letter of credit, that oftentimes letter of credit or thing of value has been misrepresented or used twice when the intention for it to be only used once. So if I create a system of moving the value, things of value, or dematerialized representation of things, you know, these things of value between multiple entities, then if one entity can hold it at one point, I'm suddenly preventing double spend, which is also what we have learned from the Bitcoin network. But to prevent that, we also want to have an auditable trail, and we also want to be able to ensure that all the participants in this network, which is what you see above, have access to the audit network because they have equal stake in this network. Contract is an important element. Contract is if then else rules. There are two elements of contract. One element.
If you have your phone on, could you put your phone on mute, please, if you're not speaking? Thank you.
Right. So in this case, you'll have contract, which again, simple contracts, if then else rules that, you know, and these contracts are, the industry uses the word smart contracts. I'm yet to figure out why they call smart contracts because it's essentially a code where you're looking at, using things like escrow, using things like oracles, who are sort of the bot intermediaries in the system, which says that I will only release the asset once I receive the money. So while we are trying to mimic the notion of counterparties, we're using the vehicle of smart contracts to add value in terms of enforcing the rules of the network. We're saying that, look, I may not trust the other party, but I trust the system trusts these different escrows. And you'll find that many of these networks that are emerging are using this smart contracts or contracts heavily to be able to institute that level of execution, to ensure that when transfer happens, there are rules in place. Slide 7, now we are slowly diving into deeper aspects of what blockchain is. Shared ledger technology allowing, and again, I personally and many of our cohorts who are neck deep into these conversations, I do discern between shared ledger technology and blockchain, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But shared ledger, the idea is that if shared ledger is allowing the various participants that we talked in the previous slide in a business network to have access, and I don't want to use the word C because C is an interesting word that I don't want every transaction to be visible to every party because that will break many of the existing regulation around PCI DSS and privacy and confidentiality of the participants. But accessibility of not just the system of record that the transaction system called blockchain maintains, but also for the regulators to be able to listen in and understand. And this sort of, on the long run, makes the notion of AML, KYC, and in many of the fraud analytics a lot easier. I'll spend more time on that as I delve into the technical components of this. So I think we have some music here, and I'm not sure what to do about that, but I'll continue with my conversation.
Yes, someone must have put us on hold.
Yes, be careful. If you have music on hold, do not put your phone on hold. I guess you can hang up and dial back in again if you have to, but don't put it on hold.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so the whole thing here, that shared ledgering is that heart of that system, and I'll break down between what shared ledger is and what blockchain is. Now, let's look at the problems, right? I talked about the problems of, this is slide 8. Slide 8 talks about the real problem that we're trying to solve with the existing financial networks. So today we have EDI, and this is, again, ledgering back to about 30-plus years. When we had EDI, electronic data interchange formats, we had SWIFT formats, we have different ISO formats, all geared towards ensuring that as things move, as money moves, as ledger entry moves between multiple parties, we are able to use these data formats as to standardize them so things become much faster. So all the initiative that we see in Europe and United States and many of the emerged economies towards making things easier for the emerging economies is saying, look, if we all agree on a data format, if there's a standardized data format that I can use to be able to exchange data, exchange ledger entries, suddenly things become easier because suddenly I have systems that can automate the understanding and updates of my ledger entries. But in spite of those attempts that have been happening from past decade, you still find there are incidents, whether incidents are promoted by mergers and acquisitions, incident promoted by poor programming techniques or different programming techniques. Or, for example, you have entities like SWIFT and ACH who act like centralized entities, which suddenly are become the conduit of amalgamating information between these different entities. These, over time, have added to inefficiency and expensive and vulnerable that every time a data format changes, suddenly I have to update all my systems, which can be an expensive process. And get this, that Euroclear, and there was a pretty nice paper from Oliver Raymond, and I'll be happy to share that with the team here, that Euroclear calculates that in the U.S. and United States, the IT and operation expenditure for capital markets is currently close to $100 to $150 billion per year among banks. On top of that, which is essentially keeping the ledger entries in check, the post-trade and security servicing fees is close to about $100 billion. So the system itself, every year, doing this sort of entry reconciliation is costing the industry anywhere between $250 billion and above, right? And all this is happening because of the fact of redundant and duplicative systems, right? And so that alone, I think, has become an interesting challenge that in my conversation with clients, there are really two streams of conversation. One stream is, how do I decommission my redundant systems and make things more efficient because it's costing me a lot of money? And the other stream of conversation is, how do I keep up with the Ripple and Sophies of the world who are constantly taking advantage of that friction and creating a disruption for me, right? So if you look at what has happened with Dodd-Frank, Regulation CF passed, paved the way for suddenly having crowdfunding platforms, which suddenly money moves away from, for example, the retail banking and the investment banking world to the crowdfunding platform where me and you, who get minuscule amount of money from a checking account, suddenly moves into a platform that gives me 2 or 3% more than what I would get from my existing account. And if those small capitals move to this crowdfunding platforms, then the role of banks who have been traditionally our credit engine of a society, suddenly that stream dries up. So that's a disruption that many of these companies are looking into, that look, if this existing system, which has served us well so far, has created friction for the new age, which is the new age of how me and you and everybody else interact with the digital world around us and how our millennials are looking into the digital world and having a completely different perspective on what they want to do and how they want to invest the money, then suddenly they have skin in the game to understand that friction. So slide 9 takes that model of inefficiency of slide 8 and say, in a perfect world, if, let's say, all the participating entities were to have access, and I don't say visibility, I'm saying access, to the ledger, then apparently now I don't have to expend time in the back-end processes that I have invested money and time and making it more efficient, right? And so, again, that is the holy grail of what we want to achieve with the business networks, that you have multiple counterparties. The role of ACH and SWIFT may eventually shift to them either being operators or owner of the network, while each bank may provide some sort of a computer equity to participate in the network. And that's the world we're envisioning, where you have consensus. Consensus, again, is that trust system that we are trying to institute in this environment to be able to make things more efficient, to disintermediate some of the counterparties that are getting paid historically either because of their presence in the ecosystem or the fact that the industry thinks that they're getting paid for really doing not a whole lot, right? And then you have provenance, which, again, give you the historical context. Think of this from the perspective of, something like AML, which is really a post-transaction activity. Allowing them to link the various transactions and achieve it in real time, as opposed to, and I read the statistics that only about 35 or 40% of AML cases are identified, not even prosecuted, and 60 plus just goes unidentified. In this day and age, I think that becomes an important element, where each banks are spending enormous amount of money and time in expending analytics resources to be able to figure this out in real time so they can actually go after the bad people, including the regulation that the federal governments of different countries are imposing on, again, U.S. Patriot Act, and stuff around making sure the money doesn't end up in wrong hands. Slide 10. I do want to bring this big, no one really wants to talk about the financial world. We do want to make sure that we address that, look, Bitcoin is unregulated, censorship-resistant shadow currency, and while it has its advantages and you'll have the ecosystem called sidechains popping up, in ensuring that for a regulated industry, including IBM's point of view, is the fact that it has challenges from, again, KYC, AML, and hence it becomes enormously difficult to include this and tie this to fiat currency. So every time you tie something to fiat currency or be able to sell and buy something, you have to ensure that you're able to tie this to the recipient and the origination of the currency, which is a challenge today. So while you'll find Amazon and many of the companies like Overstock are accepting Bitcoins, but their responsibility ends with the exchange that's sitting between them and the Bitcoin ecosystem to be able to convert that Bitcoin into fiat currency and move the money to the Amazons of the world, which again makes it easier for them to report in terms of taxing, in terms of accounting regulations and things like that. But this is truly a challenge today from our perspective, and that's why we want to create something that mimics. Slide 11, and now we are now entering into some of the technology element of this. And I think when we talk about this from a capital markets perspective in terms of reconciliation settlement, this is where I think X9's role becomes very valuable. And I'll try to spend some time in the QA session. I'd love to hear your opinion on this. I've analyzed, not all of them, but in the past 2 years, I use the word 4,000 fintech companies, and many of them are blockchain companies, have popped up. And I have analyzed that, look, what can be so revolutionary that these companies have really, really done so much exponential work in the past 2 years? What is so radically different from what we know as blockchain, which is combination? So any blockchain company that you come across have these four elements, right? They all have a shared ledger, which is essentially a system of record. It's append-only or immutable system of record, which basically is shared across multiple business networks, which, again, allows you to do transactions, and every time you add a transaction, you add to the block, and hence the word blockchain, that each block is nothing but a batch of transactions, and every time you create a transaction or make a change, you create a new transaction on top of it. And that's why address some of things like provenance in supply chain world, that we know where this is coming from. Of course, in Bitcoin world, everything is open. In our regulated world, it cannot be open. So we're looking at enormous type of schemes where we can sort of do encrypted transfer of the data, make sure we're using things like fractal visibility of data and some of the technical components around butterfly keys and how will the shared key mechanism work and what's happened historically from a cryptography perspective. So this is of interest, and I'll spend more time on this a bit deeper, but that's the foundational element of some of the, all of the blockchain technologies that you see there. Then you have smart contract, which is essentially the contract that I discussed earlier, if-then-else rules, the business term that are embedded to enable transaction. Smart contract can be used not just for the notion of transactions, but again, inducing some of the conditional statements in this financial network that we're talking about here. Then you have privacy and validation. Privacy is all about cryptography, right? So this is where I think some of the stuff that you've seen, again, I tend to classify the classic and modern day cryptography, right? So anyway, of the evolution that we've seen from RSA and Diffie-Hellman to what we're seeing today now in terms of elliptic curve, and looking at figuring out as to how does, what we have known as trapdoor function work, how does elliptic curve make that more efficient, and figuring out the math and figuring out the scalability requirements. And this is where you'll find that privacy, making sure the transactions are secure, authenticated, and verifiable leads towards the finality of it, which is a big thing in the financial services. So if you combine privacy and validation, which is essentially what, again, if you look at the way Bitcoins work, combination of that cryptogram and the ability for us to use the trapdoor, which, again, reverse resolving that cryptogram into the transaction is the proof of work, is one of the algorithms that the Bitcoin world uses. Validation is that consensus mechanism that ensures that if there's a change in the network, in this business network that we've been talking about, how does that change get validated and confirmed, which is essentially the transactional element of the blockchain world, right? Now, more about these later, but these are the four elements, the four building blocks of any blockchain solution in the world. So no matter who claims to be blockchain, they will have two elements. And what they have done, and what many of the blockchain companies have done, is tweaked the privacy element and tweaked the validation element and say, look, I think this validation is best for this use case, be it, you know, trade financing, be it trading platforms, be it exchanges, be it capital markets, reconciliation, settlement, you know, what have you. Any of these use cases, they have tweaked validation and said that this consensus makes sense for this, and adding a specific crypto algorithm on top says, look, we believe, or the startup company or any company that's inducing that model believes that if you induce that if you tweak those, you know, elements of it, then that is specific for use case, which means that every single use case that the financial industry, and I've spent a lot of time in percolating down to about 8 different use cases that majority of money is going into, and those 8 are trading platforms, capital markets, trade financing, remittances, smart contracts, identity management, crowdfunding, data management, and marketplace lending. These are the areas where the investment today is going into from a blockchain perspective. And if all they're doing is changing the crypto modules and consensus algorithms, then our point of view is that if we were to provide, and this is exactly where our work, IBM enters into blockchain world, announcing the, you know, one of the leading and founding members of the Linux Foundation called Hyperledger, with other technology and the financial service entities, is if we were to induce the platform-centric approach where we give modularity to many of these modules, allowing our customers to create their own blockchain applications, and then going after the 4,000 companies who are claiming to be blockchain, for example, and saying if you adhere to these certain standards, which is the opinion that I had before I started this conversation, is that there are really no standards around it. Having those standards allows the industry to consume this in a more to consume technology in a more in a fashion that's compliant to the existing systems, in a fashion that allows them to integrate with the existing systems, and also enable that regulatory requirement that each of them would have to endure. Right, and so from that perspective, these have become interesting challenges. Now, if you look at the financial institution, looking at the red box, which is on slide 11, you can essentially build a shared flat ledger using blockchain technology that can manage by trusted processing nodes, right? So you have different nodes that provide trust validation systems. And if we are trying to mimic, and this is the most important element of this, if disintermediation is the goal, and if you're trying to mimic the trust provided to us by the counterparties, then what would that trust look like? And it should have the tenets or the characteristics of non-repudiation, the characteristic of ability for me to be able to prove a transaction, the ability for me to be able to reverse a transaction. And these are the few things that IBM and many other corporations, because we understand transaction systems, are working towards, inducing some of the vehicle that using things like digital signatures, financial intermediaries can update the ledger to complete a business transaction. And the shared ledger needs to be encrypted to protect the confidentiality of data, the key processing involved in executing a trade, like security issuance, trading, clearing, settlement, be redesigned and simplified using such a solution, right? So that's essentially what we're heading at, which today the fintech community is only focused on development of assets and not looking into some of the underlying principles that we have built over time. And so if you're aspiring to induce that counterparty system that we have built over time in multiple and have the same level of trust, not only we have to mimic that model, but we also have to make sure it's economical and it's fast enough. Therein lies the problem, where if you look at any of the existing blockchain model, they're going towards anywhere between, saying, 6 to 9 to 10 different transactions per second, whereas the industry, which is the work that we have been doing with the various financial institutions, the big banks, the Visa and MasterCard, the network, we measure transactions as 100,000, 100 or 1,000 transactions per second. We don't measure them in units. And this is where I think some of the work that we have to do, and again, after introduction of RSA and Diffie-Hellman, researchers explored additional mathematic-based cryptographic solutions looking for other algorithms beyond sort of factoring and multiplying effect, which would be a good trapdoor function inducing that level of, you know, visibility, that level of security authentication model of it, and making sure that the you know, again, the elliptic curve, type cryptography was really to make sure, how do we make this more efficient? Because if you look at the amount of money we would have to invest in just the hardware element of it, right? So if I'm looking at 10, so let's say blockchain promises the speed and promises the transactionality and promises the security that we seek in our systems. But if it's giving me 10 transactions per second or 15 or 20, for me to be able to scale the systems to going towards addressing 1,000 or 100,000 transactions per second, I suddenly have to invest so much more money to be able to have an infrastructure to reach the transaction goals that we have, not to mention that if we were to achieve the promise of the digital engagement, the transaction rate will only exponentially go high up, right? That is the problem, and this is where I think X9 can help. Second problem is, and I've written extensively about this in my LinkedIn blog, is each of these technology individually, right, have existed forever. We've had shared ledger, and whether it's a RDBMS or relational database or NoSQL database, we've had the notion of a distributed database for over 30 years, right? We've had smart contract, which is nothing, business process management, for over 20 plus years in different format, whether you use C, C++, Java, BPM. It has its own set of evolution. If you look at cryptography, again, we have moved from the traditional set of, for example, symmetric, asymmetric keys to public key, cryptography, and going towards the elliptic curve. So even cryptography in general has evolved over time to make sure that we are using the appropriate algorithms to be able to satisfy the requirements of the financial industry, whether it's, going towards transactional finalities, authentication, and beyond the simple fact that, look, I can transfer the packet securely, is making sure that the identity is packed into to what we're doing. And then you have validation. The cloud world has used consensus, and we've used consensus in clustering world. So ever since clustering has emerged in our high availability world, and this has, again, been over 20 plus years. So if you look at each of these boxes, they have existed over 20 plus years. So my question that I always question now is, why is it relevant now? Why is blockchain so cool if each of these boxes that sort of collectively compose the notion of a blockchain as a singular technology solution for transactions, why is this cool now? And after doing a lot of research, I realized that this is a perfect intersection of the economical viability of technology. Suddenly now the compute power, whether it's CPU memory and some of the hardware crypto cards and what we have done, has become economical enough for it to address it, and the need, right? At this point, the friction in financial services and various industries. So this is a perfect intersection of economical viability of these collectively together. Because if you look at each of these boxes, they all represent high compute-intensive operations, high network I/O for consensus, a high algorithm for consensus. Cryptography, again, is a very CPU-intensive process. Shared ledgering, which is a high data structure memory-intensive process. Smart contract, again, is a CPU and memory-intensive process. So collectively, it's a perfect storm in the computing world. And today, we have compute power enough available at economical cost for us to make this possible. And there's a problem in the industry. So this is what makes it so much more interesting now than ever before, that suddenly now there's momentum and time going into this to be able to say, look, we can do this economically. And so this, again, goes back to the previous discussion, is as we design system, as we go towards the core charter of the X9 Standards Committee for Banking, is for you to be able to devise standards and understand as to if the goal is to be able to speed things up, if the goal is able to disintermediate or remove from the counterparties, then I have to mimic the same level of trust. And for that, to create that trust system, and I'm using the word trust system broadly, combining the privacy and validation boxes in slide 11, that I have to create a system that mimics it and makes it more efficient. And this is where I think that if you look at, and I was talking to Steve and Todd earlier, is that if you look at the ASC committee, or the Accredited Standards Committee for X9, composed of four subcommittees, right? And this is my research that I had done yesterday in preparation for this call, is you have X9AB, which for, paper electronic, for retail and corporate card type stuff. Then you have X9 for credit, X9C, D, and F, addressing different facets of a financial system. I think that each of these four subcommittees has a use case that somehow intersect with the blockchain world. Then collectively, I think X9 has a significant role to play, only because you're now entering towards standardizing and facilitating the banking operations. And so we are looking at things like what standards need to be followed, whether it's from a hardware perspective, what do we do on a crypto, accelerator card. And again, my purview, when I reached out to Todd and Donna, who are leading our efforts from IBM perspective, is purely from making this real for our customers. Like, look, I can't really spend $500 trillion for infrastructure needed to reach the transaction speeds. But then we also discovered the requirements such as HSMs, the role of HSMs for efficient key management, the role of crypto accelerators for me to be able to speed up the transactions and offload some of the high intensive processes on the specialized card, thereby reducing the footprint that I need. But if I end up doing that, if I end up taking some of the elements of this mathematical operations required for cryptography on the specialized card, then what are the standards? And what do banks need to do to understand that? And I think that seal of approval, like we have seen over the past 30 years with PCI DSS and Safe Harbor and many of these compliance requirements, gives us the faith and the required stability in the system, which says, yes, as long as there are taking 300 minds on this call and devising that standard will help us in ensuring that this is adoptable and adaptable by the financial services, because we can only do so much. And this is the reason why IBM did this with Linux Foundation, is to bring and rein in that wild west world of blockchain to say, let's create certain generally acceptable standards around the data format, around the consensus algorithm, and so on and so forth. With that, slide 12, 13 really goes into some of the elements that I've already discussed here. Slide 15 talks about validation, which is, in my opinion, the heart of blockchain. So again, trust systems or consensus systems essentially, have to make sure that whatever we devise for a certain asset type for the business network is agreeable about different members, right? And that this is basically a mathematical way of ensuring that I'm replacing the counterparties that have been providing the value and speed things up, right? So consensus system to me becomes, and you have many, you have proof of stake, proof of work, which is used by Bitcoin, Sieve. So you have many different algorithms that have been utilized over time. And interestingly enough, if you look at the electrical curve, the factoring not being the hardest problem for Bit Basic, for example, but you have specialized algorithms like quadratic sieve. So we've taken the concept of the sieve, this from IBM research, applied that to, say, PBFT, which is another consensus algorithm from Practical Byzantine Fault Tolerant Network, which assumes that in any business network, there may be bad players trying to exploit the system, and that's, again, a rational behavior. How do you contract with that system and make it more efficient from an algorithm perspective that I don't have to invest the amount of resources needed to support some of these algorithms that are completely, that are well understood but simply don't scale? So I would expend energy on some of that from as technologists and as the leaders who are setting those standards for banks. And after 16, why? I have provided some of the use cases in terms of industrial benefit of blockchain, looking into pattern of customer adoption, which is slide 19, which again are the four different conversations we're having with our financial services clients, which allows us to say, if I'm doing internal ledger, I may not have to worry about, simply because of the fact that any system that we are creating for a business network should be decentralized, which means that nothing can be centralized, should also be non-monopolistic, meaning that no single entity should have monopoly, and hence the word decentralized, which also implies the fact that when we design, I ensure the unlinked identities, meaning that if I were to start having a system that gives user ID and password, that becomes a centralized system for the network. So how do I preserve the isolated authentication and authorization system that each of these participants have, and yet let them participate in the network with accountability and repudiation that's needed for any transaction in the event of a question or in the event of a questionable transaction, and auditing, of course. And so these things become relevant when we have to say, if a client wants to use blockchain for internal, because internal systems are completely controlled by a single entity, which is the enterprise. And so the notion of decentralization, the notion of non-monopolistic application of these becomes an interesting challenge, because you can do that. But you can still exploit the notion of shared ledgering. And this is where I discern between shared ledgering and blockchain. I can still leverage shared ledgering for ensuring that multiple systems kept inside, whether it's custody or asset management and treasury, are in sync, which I don't have to spend enormous amount of money and time to keep them in sync. It's still a valid use case. So some of these are popping up, and you'll find that slide 19 to slide 27 really discusses some of the financial and non-financial use cases. Because we are IBM and we are technology providers, we are going after healthcare industry, we're going after supply chain, we're going after trade financing, which has some intersection with financial services. But our purview is how do we, again, make the systems more efficient, and we are as much to lose only because we have been the purveyors of transaction systems. And if financial services or any other industry is viewing fintech as the disruptive model, we also have the same perspective that if blockchain becomes that sort of the system of record and system of transaction, then it's as disruptive it is to us as it is to financial services from that perspective. So slide, again, till 27, we go into, we review it at your own leisure in different use cases. And slide 28 goes towards how can we help. And again, I don't think this is the right audience for it. The intent of this call was not to do any selling on this call, but to be able to reach out with the industry and make sure that we have the right leaders and who are informed and communicate our point of view and the industry challenges. So we can go to work towards creating that set standardized format which will help the financial services in adopting blockchain. With that, I think I've consumed an hour, and I want to leave 30 minutes for a more richer conversation and your perspectives as well. Steve and Todd, with that, I think we should open this for Q&A.
Okay. Thanks, Nitin. That was very interesting, and I know we have a number of questions. I'll start off. I have a couple. One of the things you mentioned several times was that there were some opportunities for X9 to address some of the standards. Can we get into that in a little more detail? Maybe this is not the right time for that, but we're definitely interested in working on blockchain technology and getting more involved with that. Is there any like main topics to be the first ones we should look at?
Yeah, I would actually work on, so there are two things. So my biggest problem, so I have two roles. I have a business role where I serve as director of blockchain labs, which means that I'm client-facing for all clients and that will interface with IBM development research teams. So it gives me front row seats to stuff that's happening. And if I would expend energy from this group perspective, I'd focus on those two boxes, the cryptography and the consensus. They're related, right? To me, it's one box because you can't have consensus till. So consensus is built upon the cryptograms that are involved, are involved in that system, right? So if you look at these standards, so today we talk about, elliptical curl, digital signature algorithm type cryptography that's involved in Bitcoin world. Again, there are specialized algorithms, like I mentioned, quadratic sieve, general number and field sieve, and some of the sieve theories that are popping up. I would expect to at least get a perspective from your group on the challenges. And I've actually asked IBM Research to do the same thing. I have a matrix I'd like to fill up and list out the challenges, whether it's scalability, and figure out as to which algorithm and which cryptography makes sense for what use cases. Same thing with consensus, right? Consensus is tied to cryptography, where consensus, you have BFT, PBFT, Raft, Paxos. Google has their own. So Google has this, Paxos, and Raft comes from Stanford. And you have many of these and variation of these trying to work with cryptography to provide the trust system. And I think having a perspective and some sort of saying, look, this from, if a recommendation comes from X9, this is where we can use all the brains. And again, I'm by no means to the caliber of you, Steve, and Todd, and your cohorts in this group. But having a guidance from X9 to say, we have done this work, and for these use cases, these algorithms make sense because of these use cases. Right? I think that's where this will be helpful. And I have, a chart that I'm trying to build, and for me, it's harder because I don't have, I'm learning this as we go from a crypto perspective. I have the enterprise knowledge. So it's easy for me to tie that in, but the ability for me to be able to say that this crypto makes sense for this, and this will allow us to have transactional velocity, transactional integrity, the speed, the scalability, and this algorithm makes sense for real money or payments or things of more intense or more stringent consensus, only because there's real value and real money required, as opposed to, let's say, mortgage documents, which I don't really have to expend the kind of compute capacity because the risk is very low in those use cases. And all we're doing is trying to make system more efficient by ensuring the update is happening at the same time to all the parties involved. That is where I could use your help.
It
sounds like you need a matrix of for different use cases, have different requirements and different levels of encryption, and probably different volumes associated with it as well. We would be very happy to work with you on that. We have dedicated cryptographic people from RSA, NIST, just about any of the cryptographic companies we have representatives. So that would be something we would be very happy to work with you with.
No, I'll be happy. Again, we can have iterations of conversations in terms of, I'll be happy to share my ask from research with you. I'll filter out a few client-specific information. And I think I had the same comment with Claudia and I think Dan from her team in terms of how the work that Claudia and her team is doing with the digital currency group sort of ties into this model. Because if digital currency becomes, and I think this week alone and last week, Australia, the Reserve Bank of Australia, China, JP Morgan, they all have talked about movement of digital currency on these, you know, if that becomes relevant, then there's a convergence between that work that her team is doing and the work that your team is doing, and there's an intersection there in the long run.
Steve, this is Ed Scheid, and Nitin, I chair security for X9, so I'm obviously taking notes. I'd like to be able to get back with you and, you know, try to create this matrix. I can remember past years X9 had some beginnings, I'll say it that way, looking at a similar type thing, perhaps not identifying use cases per se, but looking at the, you know, the math and what a crypto algorithm or a set of algorithms can do. So I'd like to be able to work with you on that.
Sure, absolutely. And I'll tell you this, I have 6 GB. I've been working with this actively for the past 8 months. And I have use cases which are very well defined and customers that are spending real money to achieve those. And there's some use cases that people are kicking ideas around with. And I'll be happy to removing our client confidential information, speak about them generically and their value proposition of those use cases. Happy to do that.
That would be great because
that's a good start, right?
Box we need to get started. Another question in the like the validation areas. Do you see any areas where we could help out in that?
Friday night is working. I don't know if anything happened over the weekend, but Friday night.
Somebody needs to mute their phone. We can hear a conversation going on in the background.
I don't think this is the conference we thought it was.
It was working.
Does anybody else have any questions they want to ask?
When you say this is not the conference it was, I mean, did it make sense what I said, or are you expecting more? I can go as deep as you want technically, but I figured I'll set the primer up front and maybe we can have a follow-on con. Because there are many, many questions that many of my customers pop up, and I want to give enough time for the half an hour to be able to address that.
Okay. Anybody else have some questions they'd like to ask?
This is Alan, Steve. I have one question. Is there any discussion going on related to mobile payments that you could share?
Yeah, so that's interesting, right? Because I used to lead mobile payments from a technical perspective for IBM a while back, and if you look at many of the companies, so Ripple, of course, leads the pack, and you have their work with Earthport. So to form that notion of, and again, Ripple technically is a shared ledger technology, not exactly a blockchain technology. This goes back to my discerning between the two. But they have done some good work in terms of, you know, creating that network and sort of addressing the inefficiencies in terms of the time and cost it takes to move money. So I think that is a testament in its own right in terms of what's possible. And they have made some recent announcement from that perspective. Now, when you look at mobile money, this becomes or mobile payments in general. I've always equated mobile payments to two elements, which is security and engagement. So today, while there are close to about 70,000 different wallets in the world, and pretty much a growing diaspora. In fact, one-fourth of the all money that was from venture capitalists were gone towards payment and remittances. The idea of many of the companies of Square and PayPal and many of the subset of including the recent work that has been done by Braintree and I forget the name of the company at the moment, is addressing the engagement piece of it. So while mobile payments is there to make sure that you're able to remove the friction in paying the money, and interesting companies are doing stand-in services to speed things up in terms of payment while everything is still riding on the same rails that as we know it. But the idea is to gain engagement insights from it and improve the networks from in terms of providing value-add services. So Stripe is the company that was, the name I was looking for, yesterday announced that they're going into doing a whole lot of B2B type work, electronic invoicing, and connecting the various business network from receiving, sending payments, opening a business, going towards the vision of this notion of business network we talked about. So if you need to open a business today, you could potentially use Stripe network from end to end, receiving e-invoices, opening up a business, incorporating in Delaware, for example, accepting payments, all that can happen within a matter of a day. And so to in my opinion, the notion of the mobile payment companies are really inching towards that notion of connecting to the extended business network and hitting towards that engagement element of the end consumer, because that's where the millennials are going. Right. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Just a further follow-on, if I may. So what about the authentication or credentialing aspects in mobile? Is there any application of your blockchain thinking that applies there?
Yeah, we do. So if you look at, again, I spend a lot of time on payment tokenization back in the day before EMV was launched, before Apple Pay was launched, and tokenization did some things for us, right, did interesting things for us. And then the idea now is not just tokenizing the card numbers, but if I can tokenize the holy grail of, I think, which is computationally very expensive, is having one token per transaction and tying token to token domains, which means that if token is valid for Amazon, only Amazon can spend that money, which is card on file type, issues. Now, the industry now is heading towards what we call identity on blockchain, which means that if I can tokenize your identity and tie that to some of identifier with your mobile device, which, by the way, the mobile ecosystem is addressing that from UUID and making sure, and this is, again, Apple and Samsung Pay, and many of them have done this fairly elegantly. But to tie that to the broader financial services ecosystem is that if I can have identity on a chain and have the tokenize that identity on a chain, suddenly I can now use the mobile payment vehicles, be it whatever wallet you're using, which is, again, a messy situation at the moment, to moving things of value, whether it's money or whatever, because I have identity also on the same blockchain network that the various financial systems interact with. Now, the only fuzzy element of that is how do we make it all work and who is in charge of identity and what happens in the event of a dispute and what we're seeing now in terms of stolen identity, because there's no such system, no matter what we say blockchain is going to be, that you still have a potential, whether it's the weakest link, which is you and your phone, or systemic risk associated with it. And that's something that's being evaluated at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Two reactions, if I may. So on mobile, you keep referring to mobile money, and I would encourage you to broaden your thinking to new apps that are not necessarily wallet-based, because I think that's going to equally be a topic of progress here as new mobile apps begin to emerge. So you'd have, other than Apple Pay and Samsung Pay types of apps out there. On the tokenization piece, from a standards perspective, please be aware, and I can talk to Todd about this offline if you'd like. We also have work going on in the ISO community on tokenization messaging for both ISO 8583, current card processing, and ISO 20022, which is the new XML repository standard.
Right. No, I think that's something which me and Todd are in constant communication. In fact, anything that comes around the space. So I'll use Todd as a conduit to the larger community.
Sure, I'd be happy to either talk to you directly about any of that, or Todd can get in touch with me, and we can arrange time to talk about those both of those areas.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Hello, Steve. Can I ask a question? This is Vin Underwood, and I'm interested in the problem of scalability from, you know, 6 to 12 transactions per second up to 5 or 6 orders of magnitude. And my question is the transaction validation. Do you believe that proof of work is essentially not really the technology we can use to be scalable to higher transaction rates?
That is a very good question. So let me give you, and I don't get enough time that as much as I want to spend on consensus systems. So if you look at proof of work, right, you get a cryptogram. Today you use SHA-256, and the entire Bitcoin network, which is about 7,000 nodes at the moment, are expanding, and all of them have gone to specialized hardware. Then we oftentimes talk about this massive systems in China who are dedicating enormous amount of computing power to be able to resolve this cryptogram, and eventually you get rewarded for that. And every year, earlier it was one Bitcoin, today I think it's like 1/12, and it's a fraction of a Bitcoin that you get as a reward, which makes the Bitcoin itself more expensive because of the network itself. So the system, the incentive economics, which is essentially the consensus system of Bitcoin, is driving, which is fueling, and the larger the block, the more security it offers to the system in general, because it takes that much more time to break all the, to redo all the transactions, and you have to then expand that compute capacity. And we did an analysis one that it may cost somebody about $500 billion, because you have 10 minutes to process about 450,000 blocks within like less than 10 minutes. And so the economics doesn't suggest for us to do that model and then go and simply buy it, because it's a lot more cheaper to buy all the Bitcoin in the system than mine it, for example, or redo it. Now, proof of work is also used in Ethereum networks, and that's why they have some of the internal currencies like Ether and gas as an expendable vehicle, which is, again, all the incentive economics dedicated to compute capacity. We believe that in financial world, your incentive economics relies on the compute, on the consensus, right? Meaning that I cannot use proof of work, because proof of work will be the incentive for someone to go ahead and use, and the fact that we have seen the amount of energy, which today you all may have heard that we are using the energy of as much as Ireland uses on the Bitcoin network collectively, and that's only going to go up as the network and the block size, block height increases. If you were to mimic that in the corporate world, in our world, in a business network, it's unsustainable, only because of the fact that not only that the networks doesn't need that level of, because if it's a permission network, then we have a subset and a smaller subset of the entire population that's participating in it. It's if it's a permission network, then you are permissioned and you have much tighter scrutiny, and we understand who it is, and there are consequences of bad behavior legally and systemically, right? So that's why I think proof of work becomes an interesting consensus model to be adopted for any business use case. And this is where I was saying earlier to Steve, and he asked the question that how can X9 help, is help us understand. And I think I've been working with researchers in terms of something like Sieve, right? We have a modification of PBFT as to what is an optimal, so we're looking at compute equity, right? What is the role of, if you look at the participants in a business network, if you are a participant like, for example, Wells Fargo, for the sake of using a big company's name here, then they obviously have larger transactions as opposed to a small community bank in Texas. But they both want to be able to benefit from the network. So you could potentially say that Texas can, the community bank can participate with a peer node whose only job is to provide by keeping a copy of the encrypted shared ledger, whereas Wells Fargo, BOA, JPMC, all the big ones, can provide the consensus validation service, which means they expend more compute capacity. And that way, we are sort of balancing between ensuring that you have enough compute equity in the system to keep the system going, and at the same time, the participants are held accountable for their actions. And that's where I think we need to come up with a model for different asset types, whether it's stocks, bonds, whatever the case is. I know it's a very broad level answer and I can go deeper, but does that make sense?
Well, yeah, it does. My question really was, and you may have answered it, is that the only way to increase several orders of magnitude of the transactions per second with the blockchain consensus model with incentive economics is to increase the block size, so you have more transactions per block, and or decrease the time it takes for block validation where you solve the hash problem. and Bitcoin is self-adjustable, where they constantly make the problem harder to keep this arbitrary 10 minutes per block. And it just seems to me that you could reduce that 10 minutes quite a bit.
Correct, we did,
and,
right.
And the important thing is the fraudster has a small percent of the total computing power of the miners in the network, not the length of time of it takes to solve the hash problem. But I still think you couldn't reduce it enough to achieve those five orders of scalability. So I think I just don't think that the idea of solving a hash problem as a incentive economic consensus model will work. We'll have to go to something else like proof of stake to get these higher.
Right, you're absolutely right. So in many cases, what we're also giving is, like, for example, some of the internal use cases, giving a client the ability to do checkpointing, meaning as the block height grows in a permission network, do we really need to go back and validate every block? And if we are saying, look, we'll only do for 1,000 blocks, and after 1,001 block, we checkpoint it, and we start doing validation from block 1,001. So we're looking, again, this is where we would need some of the, and none of this is like written in stone at the moment, we're looking at pros and cons, and I'm discussing with banks, like, look, if we do this model of checkpointing, right, meaning that I do 1,000 blocks and after 1,000 blocks, I don't have to go through validation as the block size increases, because that only adds to the massive increase in infrastructure, and if at the end of the day, we're creating another expensive system to replace an existing expensive system, then what's the point? It has to be economically, the cost of transactions for the end consumer should go down. It has to be efficient, it has to be secure. These are some of the high-level goals of this. And so in some use cases, it makes sense. And some the other use cases, like what happens to that checkpointed block? Do we leave it as it, which means that at the end of the day, it's sitting in some sort of a persistent database and eventually giving it need for us to be able to, you know, either archive it or make it immutable. So immutability is an important element of it, but how do we make that if it's persisted? And so some of these things are going on, but I completely get your point. That is a fuzzy area that while everybody is touting on shared ledgering, to me the most important element is shared ledgering is pointless till you have an appropriate consensus/trust system behind it to make sure that I'm still preserving some of the integrity of the transaction that have passed.
Thank you for that.
Yep. And if you have any thoughts, you have my email address. I every waking hour I'm spending time on what will that look like, and I don't have enough bandwidth and don't have enough computer scientists on my role. But many of you are you know, it's easy for you to sort of maybe you have access to many of the other theories or papers that you will. I'll be happy to have access to them and pass it on to the teams here. So. Any help will be appreciated from that perspective.
Okay, thanks. Anybody else have any other questions?
Hi, this is Joachim from Verifone. I think you answered my question that I'm about to ask, but I just want to kind of re-ask it in a different way. We talked about performance. I was concerned a little bit that performance is almost an intractable problem a little bit from a blockchain perspective just because of some of the issues you kind of mentioned. But is performance the biggest issue, or is there a bigger issue you think and that needs to be solved as part of either standardization or you mentioned cryptography as well, kind of standardizing the crypto? Is there a bigger issue that needs to be solved?
Yeah. So I think one leads to the other, right? Meaning that, and I constantly worry about this piece, is that if we are trying to replace the counterparty intermediaries, right, that we have to have an equivalent trust system, and I define some of the tenets. It has to be fast, it has to be cheap, it has to keep up with the transaction rates of our digital world that we live in, right? And so if you look at Square and PayPal, they're doing interesting things like stand-in services. Again, you know, from your perspective, from a point of sale to anything between you and hitting the networks, they're doing interesting things to speed that up, right? And so speed is an important element of it. Otherwise, what's the point of, you know, if you're trying to reduce T plus 2 to T plus 0, then the speed is certainly an element of the whole thing. But I think to be able to get the speed with the relative assurances that, you know, again, engagement and security pieces of it, that I have to have enough. And if you apply many of the more stringent cryptography, which ensures that it becomes difficult and the incentive to break this means that you apply more resources, which means cost, you're sort of giving that level of the fact that, look, this is a fairly robust crypto algorithm. But to be able to achieve that, I'm expending more hardware resources to achieve that level of computation required mathematically. So they're all linked, in my opinion. The help I would need is that I'm dealing with now, so let's say clearing and settlement, securities trading. moving money across borders. These are some of the distinct use cases that money is going into. And if we were able to define some of the, whether it's a set or a certain couple of appropriate crypto that makes sense, first makes sense for that use case, and then eventually figuring out as to how do we optimize the performance. And this is why I reached out to Todd to see, you know, if we were to do this in a cloud environment, because that's the tendency of banks today, let's move this in the cloud because, it's, you know, I can buy this for a fraction of a cost. But if I offload some of this to a specialized hardware devices, can I make this more efficient and cheaper per transaction, which is per transaction rate? So I think it's one thing that leads to another, and they're all related, in my opinion. Does that make sense? I mean, I know it was a long-winded answer, but...
No, thank you.
Anybody else have a question?
Yeah, just a thought as well. You know, as I look at this, and you know, as appealing as it may be, you know, I think one of the biggest concerns that stands out in my mind would be still the performance, you know, and then the privacy, right? Is that the feedback you've been getting from, you know, when you reach out to the masses? You know, is there a concern more with performance and privacy, performance in terms of scalability and being able to handle the volume, and then, of course, data privacy in this environment?
Right. So that's a good question. Only from the computer scientists, not from business. So this group, I expected these answers. But if I talk to business, I don't think many of them even have a clue of what this conversation is all about. Only because some of them are infancy of either their journey and maybe they're focused only on business. So it's not a ding on them. I'm just saying that it's just a matter of our vantage point. I'm saying this and you're saying this because of the role that we both have on this call, right? You're the history of cryptography and what you guys have been doing, and you understand. So for you to be able to wire them together, it's interesting. Whereas a business analyst who's looking at saying, look, crowdfunding is going to disrupt my bank, how do I use it? And they see blockchain as a hammer to solve that problem. They're looking at, okay, let me only look at shared ledgering. They do quick POCs on using one of the cloud-provided services and say, look, this works. And my vantage point is, like, not so fast, right? We have to still address some of the intricacies of how this would actually work when we are having real assets and real money in the system. So only from a few large banks and their computer scientists who are involved in this, I have this conversation with them, but general business, in most cases.
Yeah, because, you know, I think, you know, as I look at slide number 11, you know, with the blockchain for business and those four boxes, I mean, those basically spell it out quite clearly. And, you know, I've sort of drawn, you know, ellipses around, you know, the pairs that are relevant, right? You have the privacy and validation pair, and you have the, you know, the validation and the shared ledger pair. You have the smart contract and the privacy pair. Right, and then you have the validation and the shared ledger pair. You know, so it's sort of, you know, while they're all intertwined, once again, the performance is what I'm concerned with as you dump, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of records across these things, to, you know, within, you know, nanoseconds to get things done. That's where the concern, I think.
Absolutely. And I think, to me, forget the nanosecond at the moment, I simply want to be able to match with existing transaction rates. So, for example, mortgage industry, right? Mortgage industry transaction rate is not very high. If you look at collectively, it's anywhere between, you know, a few thousand a month, or depending on which bank you talk to. But of course, if you look at some of the stock transactions or exchanges, very high transaction rates, right? Depending on, you know, if you take the big markets as opposed to, say, Lithuania or Latvia or any of the smaller countries which have much smaller, you know, rates. So I simply want to be able to create a system that one is able to provide same level of security and transactionality at the same rates that I have today before I even go into improvising it. Because if I'm not able to provide that, then no one's going to expend $20 million to solve a $2 million problem.
Exactly.
So it has to make sense economically. And this is why I think that I reached out to Todd and Donna and many of our researchers in between that, look, not today, but whenever this becomes real for business, it should not just be a moniker for IBM to say, look, we want to make it real for business, but we haven't thought. So we, as a team, which today is growing under leadership of many of our executives, is to be able to bring that thinking to the enterprise that, look, you've done the initial testing. Now let's see what it takes for you to be able to prove this to the world. And we've announced, like, Blockchain Garage now. only to address some of these the stuff that me and you are discussing on this call.
Fenton, I got a question for you. If I look at your slide, if I look at your slide 11, what I see is a need for all four blocks. It's a great slide. But if I said to you, what you really need is a way to have differential access to the various components proportional to the need of the viewer.
Right.
That's not access. You try to watch your choice of words in terms of access and view.
Right.
If we could do that, we could reduce the amount of computational time. We could use cryptography to give you your data integrity, and we could maintain the confidentiality as well. Would that seem to fit what you're asking for?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is this, right, that while everybody says, look, shared ledger, shared ledger, shared ledger, because you have provenance, you have a historical context of every transaction, while I may want to be able to refinance the mortgage and mortgage may move from X bank to bank Y, and I don't have to pay $6,000 because of doing all that validation again because my mortgage ledger is there and all I have to do is move the ledger entry. But remember, it also has all the transactions of Nitin with the X bank. So while I want to move the mortgage ledger, I don't want to move my customer relationship with it. So I want to be able to encrypt the data and only provide partial visibility or fractal visibility for the other bank, and that way I'm only dealing with the asset in question but not the entire relationship chain.
Terrific. That's exactly what I was asking. Thank you very much.
Right. But the thing is, to achieve that, it's an interesting challenge because suddenly beyond the cryptography and consensus, which is sort of the trust system combined, the encryption itself has a higher imposition on the compute resources. That you're going above and beyond what Bitcoin does today, because suddenly now I'm dealing with data encryption here and fractal, and then key distribution between who does what and how do I move keys as I'm moving transactions over. That imposes more stress on the already stressed system, and that's where I think I need your help in terms of saying what is more efficient for a bank.
Super, thank you.
Okay, we may have time for one more quick question.
Yeah, I think today I earned my living, I think.
Over time, do you anticipate the size of these shared ledgers becoming a computing issue?
I think so. That's why we are in our open blockchain, which is Hyperledger Contribution, we are checkpointing stuff. Because that will be an issue even for Bitcoin, because at some point, the incentive economics makes sense today. But let's say your compute power required to solve that cryptogram quadruples and your incentive is like 1/27th of a Bitcoin, suddenly you have to start charging somebody a fraction of a Bitcoin to do some work. So you're sort of reversing the entire premise of why Bitcoin blockchain was there. So I think that will certainly be a problem going forward. And irony is that is the strength of the system, the height is the strength of the system. So if your entire strength of the system relies upon that, height validation, then on the long run, unless something changes the cost of power goes down and whatever the case is, it may be unsustainable. And we want to avoid those pitfalls knowing what we know now, right? Even though I think from the brilliance of what the Nakamoto consensus was, it's great for that small, very minute use case. But if you're designing a trade exchange system, then it has to be longer-term architecture. So we had to factor those in.
Right, that was my concern for something like a total stock market type of shared ledger. That would
trust me, guys. I think none of the performance issues ever come up in the business conversation with blockchain, right? And I think it's a concern because that I've always said this in all my writings in the blog, whatever, that whatever consensus you choose, whatever crypto module you choose, has a direct implication on the investment you make in the infrastructure. So I think these are valid points. And if collectively all 300 of us were to apply our collective power to say, look, let's create the system, which again, has been some of the charter of the specialized algorithms, then I think that would definitely go a long way in making this a reality.
All right. I think that's all the time we have. I hear some people leaving. It's 1:30. I want to thank everybody, especially thank Nitin and Todd for their time and expertise in giving the seminar. I'll be in touch with you so we can set up some follow-up meetings. And all the people that are still in line that attended, thank you very much. Then you had any last words before we end?
Thank you. This was a very good session. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.